Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey guys, it's Kayla. Candace is unable to join us today, but we are all still so directionally challenged. Am I right? We thought we'd have it all figured out by the time we were in our 30s, but surprise, we don't. And that's okay. We have an incredible guest for you today, Josh Peck. Not only is his memoir truly compelling and raw and honest and real, but our conversation with him on today's episode is as well. He is one of Hollywood's rising talents, making the seamless transition from child actor to leading man. And you have seen him in so many films, Mean Creek, The Wackness, Red Dawn. You can also see him in the Hulu series, How I Met Your Father, and in the iCarly reboot on Paramount Plus. He's best known for his roles on the Nickelodeon phenomenon Drake and Josh, for which he received a Kids' Choice nomination. He's lived so much of his life in the spotlight, and a lot of his personal journey has been made public, and he goes through that and so much more in our conversation. So without further ado, here is our lovely, wonderful conversation with Josh Peck. And we are here with Josh Peck. Josh, I am so excited that you are our guest today. I have been singing your praises all morning. Your book is fantastic. And I don't say that lightly. I listened to it on Audible, and it's so lovely because you yourself are a performer, and to hear your inflections and your voice and telling all those stories, it really is compelling. And I have to hand it to you. You go there. You are raw. You are honest. You tell us, you basically bare your soul. And I wonder what that's like writing a memoir. Is it difficult to go there, to go to these places that maybe you have to bring up and dredge up these memories that you've been trying to, you know, hide maybe for all of these years? And can you talk to us about what that experience is like?
Oh, wow. Well, first of all, thank you so much. And thank you for listening on Audible. I hope you like lists because I'm incredible at the letter S. It means a lot. And I would say, you know, it's interesting. I've lived with my story my whole life. And funny enough, the other day, because I obviously, and I'm sure we'll get to it, I talk a lot about like recovery and in the book and being sober for the last 14 years. And I was with some sober friends the other day. And I was like, you know, people are really saying I got raw in this book. Like, they're saying I was very transparent, but like, did I say too much? And they're like, no, it's just that you kind of kept it a secret. Like, you did a good job at hiding it. And it's not that I was overly trying to hide it. I grew up I was sort of the last generation before social media. So there was this idea that you kept that stuff hidden, you presented this picture of what you thought like you wanted your public image to be. And now honesty and transparency is so rewarded, especially in a world where we're constantly being fed these curated images from, you know, people's lives and Coachella, and everyone's like gets the good picture in front of the Ferris wheel, but they don't show them like waiting in line at the porta potty.
Wait, did Coachella just happen? I had no idea. I'm joking.
I guess so. I can't believe it either. It seems to have just gone under the radar.
We're recording this right now on the Monday after the first week of Coachella. And it feels like everyone and their mother went to Coachella. The whole world stopped and it was Coachella. And you're right, Josh. That's so true that we only see the curated parts of people's lives. And you were one of the first people on Vine, which obviously no longer exists, but you were really big in social media. But even still, you kept that side hidden. So I think you're right. That's why everyone's saying you went there and you went really raw, because we all know you and love you and watched you grow up on television and in the limelight. And then for you to be like, hey, this is actually what was happening that whole time is really eye-opening for us. But One of my favorite things about this book is how you talk about your relationship with your mother. I'm a mother myself. I know you are a father of a 3-year-old, and it's just really thrilling and fun. And you tell these fearless stories about the two of you. I just want to ask what made your relationship with your mother what it is today, because I know you talk about how you didn't want to grow up and be exactly like her, but there were so many things innately in you that were like her. And how has your relationship changed now today?
Well, I mean, I agree with you. I love being a parent. I find it's like literally the only thing not overrated in life. Like, I've been a SoulCycle and I've tried like the croissant donut in Brooklyn.
The cronut.
The cronut. Done it. I've done it all and it all sucks. No, it's fine, but it doesn't live up to the hype. But having a kid certainly lives up to the hype. Yeah, I mean, my mom and I sort of liken our relationship to like growing up, there were kids who had traditional family systems that I knew of, and it seemed like the parents were upper management and the kids were the employees of this closed corporation. But my mom and I were like a startup, because she was a single mom, I was an only child. And the nature of it was we were constantly like pilot and co-pilot. And she did a Herculean job of making sure that I felt security and deep love and all the things that I certainly had no part in just being a kid. But I was sort of forced to step up at a young age. And yeah, I was so much like my mom, you know, and partly because she was sort of an unrealized performer and she saw that in me, like saw this talent and a little bit a love, a proclivity for enjoying the spotlight. So as soon as she saw that, she like poured jet fuel on it. But also she just like, you know, she just is a strong, beautiful personality, a strong Jewish mother from, you know, New Jersey. So it certainly felt inescapable at a young age that I would grow up just like her. And I also had no image of my father because I never met him as counterpoint. So I think there were certainly times well into my early 20s where I was sort of rebelling against what I thought my genetic inheritance was.
Yeah, that seems to be a theme throughout the book too, your father, because it's constantly brought up. You are so open about it. You even at one point call it this non-existent relationship with your father. And the most heartbreaking moment is when you say, come on, Dad, do you mind if I call you Dad? And I just had to pause it for a minute and just went, oh, because I mean, you joke about it and you clearly have come to terms with it at this point. But how did that affect you as a child, and how does it affect you on an even deeper level being a father now yourself to a boy?
Well, I'm interested to ask, if I'm asking too much, please tell me. But like, when you say how that affected you, do you have a good relationship with your dad?
I do. And I actually am currently pregnant right now with a boy. So I'm like, oh, okay. And I have a girl. So as a mom, I have a girl. And now I'm going to be a mom to a boy. So obviously that changes things. My relationship with both my parents is very healthy, as is my husband. So that's something that we both have. But we want to make sure that we in turn have that with our own kids, which is a whole other beast.
That's, well, first of all, mazel. And now you guys can shut it down. You got one of each. You guys are crushing
it. We'll see.
It.
He's not here yet, but I'll keep you posted. But thanks.
You know, I find that to be true in a lot of people who are deeply affected by the fact that I never met my dad or what have you, is that is usually because their reference is a great relationship. And they can imagine having never lived without their father. Whereas when I, you know, compare that with other friends who either had a fractured relationship with a dad or just didn't know them. And I grew up in New York, you know, a single mom, public school, like it was so diverse, you know, socioeconomically and, you know, just ethnically, like there was just, everyone was represented. And so luckily, I certainly wasn't alone. Like there were plenty of other kids who were like, oh, like you never met your dad. I wish I never met my dad, and or I never met him either. So it's an interesting sort of thing to contend with. And it was only in having my son. And I think it'll be cool if one day I have a daughter to see what this is like. But it was only in having my son that I had this sort of full circle moment of like, sometimes we don't get the amends we deserve, but we give it to ourselves by not perpetuating the traumatic cycle. And so by being the dad for him that I wanted my dad to be for me, I felt like I was sort of like healing myself.
Yeah, you even talk about this one point where you find your half siblings on social or not on Facebook, correct?
Yeah.
On social media. Yeah. And then finding all these photos of your dad and all of that. How do you feel about, and this is just me asking as a parent too, because this is something we always talk about, my husband and I, but how do you feel about sharing your child's life on social media? It's a huge part of what you and I do. Obviously, it's a huge part. But then you're making these decisions for these younger little people who we are not sure how they're going to feel about it when they grow up.
So it's a great question. And I think any public person contends with that once we procreate and make new people. My wife and I like sort of made the decision that once he had a real face, we would not put him on social media. So right around 2.5 is when we eased out of it. And, you know, I don't have a Finsta, like, and I'm a typical proud father who just really wanted to post photos of my kid because I wanted the whole world to see how proud I was. But we made the decision and we've held pretty strong. Like we keep to it 99% of the time over almost, you know, 8 to 10 months now and going forward, because I want to give him the privilege of anonymity. And I want him to make the decision when he gets to a certain age. And I don't know what that age is. I think it'll reveal itself where if he's 9, 10, 11, 12 years old and says, Dad, I want to come with you to an event, or I want to be like, I took him to Kids' Choice the other day. And it was such a full circle moment because I've been growing up a Nickelodeon kid. I've been going for 20 years to the Kids' Choice Awards. And I was able to bring him and use a little bit of that privilege that I get from working for that company to like give him a fabulous time. And my wife held him when I walked the carpet, and I just didn't have to include him in that way. And I think it's important to give kids the privilege of anonymity and of privacy. And if at a certain age they decide that they want to give that up, then, you know, you make that decision then. What do you think?
Yeah, that I know. And so that's what we always kind of toil with, because there is this pride as a parent of really wanting to share it with people you love. And so I end up using the close friends part of the app a ton to share my own life, personal life with my daughter and now my son coming. But there are moments where I do share and then I feel this instant regret of, oh God, should I take it down? Should I not? It's this toil of, you know, what is the right way to do it? And you're right. There is no right answer, but I think trusting your gut and just, I love what you said about giving them the decision at an age and giving, it's empowering them to make the decision themselves, which is fantastic. You talked about Nickelodeon and you were so funny as a kid and you are extremely charismatic, even just through the computer right now. The charisma just kind of exudes from you. And, you know, you talk about how a lot of your book is about weight loss, too, and being identified through, you know, I guess being fat. Is that what you would call it? I mean, your relationship with food was complicated and you talk about it being really as far as you can remember and how you were 290 pounds as a kid. And not only that, you were on television, and being on television and having everyone watch you is a tall order for a 12-year-old. I believe you were 12 at the time, right?
Yeah.
And I just want to talk about, because you address body positivity too in your book, and how today is so much better than it was in the 90s. And that wasn't your experience back then. Body positivity is not something that it wasn't a term that people threw around or did podcasts about or wrote books about. And can you talk to us about what the experience was like back then compared to what you see today?
Absolutely. To your point, I was chatting with my friend on her podcast, Claudia Oshry, on The Morning Toast. And, you know, we talked about both struggling as kids and as teenagers with weight, and how, like, sometimes, and you could see it in people's eyes, like I would walk into a room and I would see something trigger in someone's eyes. And I was like, it's coming. They're going to comment on my weight. I just knew it. Like, they couldn't help themselves. And I would say, if we're looking at percentages, like 2/3 of the time, or maybe even 3/4, it was well-meaning, just inappropriate. It was not malicious. A lot of times people thought, I believe, in like a less than emotionally evolved way, maybe they don't realize how big they are. Maybe if I shame them, they'll do something about it. And I just remember that being pretty ubiquitous as a kid growing up. People felt like this was open season and that it was lack of self-control. You were slovenly or whatever, any sort of these negative attributes that you want to attach to it. And I say now, you know, weight is a manifestation of different things. Growing up as a kid, I would look at these kids who were my age, 13, 14, and maybe they had a bit of weight on them, and they'd whip their shirts off and they'd jump in the pool like it was nothing. And they would date and have fun. And these kids were superstars to me. Like, it's like, how are you able to do this? I'm like putting on 2 turtlenecks just to go outside. And so I think weight can be a manifestation of a love of life and dining and entertainment and just like enjoying good food. And it's not an issue. For me, it was a manifestation of a lot of discomfort. And food, as it is for most of us, was my first foray into, if I overdid it, it had like a numbing effect. It just would kind of allow me to leave my head. And so I utilized that for as long as I could until it really wasn't working for me anymore.
You know, I have to say, the way you write about your weight loss, you can tell you did it for you. Because, I mean, there are times when it would seem like maybe you felt like you had to defend it. But I have to be honest, I think that once you find out what works best for you and you realize, oh, this is the type of person that I want to be, I think therein lies the difference. That when you do it for just you and not for the outwardly effect, I think that that is such a huge difference. And you talk about how you felt like you were your best self once you did all that. And I just really commend the way you write about it. And I think it's a really healthy, wonderful way for kids to learn about that.
Thank you. I you know, it was the hardest chapter. My friend Ryan Holiday, who's this brilliant writer who helped sort of advise me on the book, just gave me a lot of notes. It was the one chapter of, like, I think, I don't know what there is, 17 chapters maybe. It was the one where he was like, start again. And it was because he said, this is really like the biggest inflection point in your life. And if you hide behind jokes and make light of things, people aren't going to care. And you need to write this to the 16-year-old version of you where it might make you cry. And so I tried to do that. And also, to your point, like, and I say it in the book, like, I'm not trying to talk in hyperbole. Like, I know it seems like I'm taking the piss out of myself, and I am, but I also just want to say, like, I want you to know what my head sounded like at that time, for better or for worse.
Right. And I think that's why it's so relatable. And a lot of people, we've all been there at some point in our life. And it's just so nice for someone so public to be so honest. Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare tri-term medical plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And we're back. You know, you also talk about this epiphany you had at age 12, where you realized you didn't want to be broke anymore. You didn't want to live this nomadic lifestyle that you were living with your mom. And I think that must be really difficult as a child to have this, your first real world realization and about the adult world around you. You know, you knew entertainment could change this for you. And can you talk to us about this time in your life? Because that's a huge weight to carry at 12.
I don't even know if I knew quite that entertainment could get us out of it. I just remember thinking, I was 12 years old. We would sort of vacillate. We'd have these huge swings between a very like middle-class lifestyle and then just like not enough money to buy a slice of pizza. And my mom being the single mother that she was, and she didn't have a college education, but she was like this fabulous entrepreneurial businesswoman. Like sometimes she'd make a couple placements. She was a headhunter. So she'd help people find jobs, and she'd make a couple placements and she'd be like, babe, we're staying at Atlantic City for the weekend and we're going to do this. Or she paid for my bar mitzvah in cash. Like she was, you know, awesome. But then obviously like sales, like most jobs like that, it's not always consistent. And I just remember at 12, having had like my third sort of wave of that, we don't have any money and this sucks and I hate feeling powerless, thinking, you know, if given the opportunity, if there's something within my power where I can, like if I wasn't an actor, I just think I would have found the job that you can do the youngest possible job to start bringing in money. I know I would have worked at the supermarket or whatever, like wherever they let a 14-year-old work, I would have been like, I'm in. It just so happened that I did this thing that pays you adult, like grown-up salaries. And I was like, oh, even better. How lucky.
Right. And you talk about how when you did your first movie, it was heaven. It just felt right. And you did a Nickelodeon film by the time you were 12. That basically started your career. Then you went on to the Amanda Bynes show. And this is where you met Drake Bell. And you two are magic on screen. 6 months later, you're doing your first pilot. And now you're trying to figure out how to you went from trying to figure out how to save you and your mom from poverty to being a huge TV star. I mean, that's such a huge transition to go through at such a young age. Looking back, does your sentiment change on your experience on that show? And just talk to us about this time in your life.
Totally. I mean, I've said this now, sort of, I try to say it in the book a bit, but what was interesting about our experience, right, was A, it was a kid's show, and B, there was no social media. So like, if you're on Stranger Things and it premieres Friday, by Monday, you have 10 million followers, you're massive. But Drake and Josh was watched by kids, a lot of kids. It did well for a kid's show, but it wasn't massive. And a lot of times we would do the show and I would, you know, work from 8 to 4 and I'd go home and meet up with my best friend, Len, who was just going to high school. And we'd like watch hockey at our, you know, in our apartment complex. And so I was like teetering on this very sort of average life. And then I would get to go do this job that was fantastic, that I was so proud and pleased to have, because it's the kind of comedy that I loved. So yeah, it didn't seem as special as it is today. It's certainly not as big as it is today, weirdly, because there's no residuals on kids TV. So they rerun it at nauseam. It's also a good show. Not to give it so much credit, I just mean that as a lot of kids shows have like pretty far out sort of the basis of the show, what it's rooted in is something like wizards or something, or superheroes, or no shade on Wizards of Waverly Place. I don't want Selena Gomez to come for me. I love you, Selena.
She's coming.
But like, I know it. She's thinking about Josh Peck a lot. But it was a family show, right? It was pretty like timeless. And I think that's why, you know, almost 15 years later, I'll still have 10-year-olds come up to me. So I think with social media and reruns and whatnot, over the last 10 years, it's so much bigger than it was when we were filming it. And I think that's lucky for me, because I never had to get too impressed with myself.
You talk about searching for an escape through your life and how food worked for a long time. And then fame was really enticing and really cool. But the alcohol and the pills seemed to numb, unlike any other. And, you know, at one point you were 18, you felt brave enough to, you know, venture out and maybe try a party, kiss a girl, do all these things that you didn't necessarily, that you missed out on when you were younger, being on a show and all of that. You talk about how once you started down that path, that it ruined the next 4 years of your life. We have a lot of younger listeners on this podcast that I think may find themselves in similar situations or right at that point right now in their lives. So I would love, if you feel comfortable, can you share insight about that time in your life and what you wish you would have done differently, and how maybe they can take some of this advice and implement it into their own lives?
Well, I guess I'll just start off like contextually, if anyone, you know, for most people who haven't read the book, but I lost 100 pounds by the time I was 17. I realized that I had the same mind in a new body, and that I had used sort of food to sort of numb out, to not face a lot of the things that were going on inside. And so when I no longer had food and I discovered drugs and alcohol, it was like, it was just so much more efficacious. It just worked better and it was less calories. And I sort of went on this 4-year quest, and it was also sort of, it was sort of spurred by the fact that I felt like I had catching up to do. I felt like I was owed this time to be young and stupid and to just be messing up, because so much of my life up until that point had been so structured. And, you know, there was always stakes to everything I did. And don't mess up don't mess up because you'll ruin your career and then you won't be able to support you and your mom. And now I just felt like, well, I got the body I always wanted, and now I'm just going to be typical. I didn't want to be special. I wanted to be typical. And it felt like this is what most, you know, college age kids were doing. And, you know, I wonder, there's all these studies that suggest that they say drugs should be legal because it would take a lot of the criminality out of it. You could tax it. And also they found that people who have a predisposition for drug addiction, whether they were legal or not, they would eventually fall victim to it. You know, much like alcohol, right? Alcohol is legal. And if you're predestined to be an alcoholic, like, what can you do? So I don't know what I could have told myself then or what I could tell someone listening who's predisposed. But what I would say is that try to wait. You know, you're considered not a minor, but like pediatric medicine is up till 26 years old. You are not a full adult. You're not locked into your 26 years old. Your brain is still developing. There's a lot going on. And while I totally understand wanting to be 17 and lit and drink and crush it, like, I get it. But like, if somehow you can just push it off, I think you will do far less damage to your brain going forward that'll have like long-term effects way into like you'll be 16. You'll be like, why do I always forget things? And it's like, well, you shouldn't have partied so hard when you were 19. But nevertheless, but I don't know what there is to say. Like for me, what happened was I had enough data to support that I overdo things, that drinking had started out as being fun, then fun with problems and just problems. And enough people had said enough things that had planted these seeds in my head that I always say like it grew into a truth forest, right? So in the moment I was like, yeah, whatever, pass the joint. But over time their words would just grow and things till eventually when I got into recovery, drinking and using was ruined for me because they were like, your best thinking got you a front row seat here. So why would you trust your brain? Right? Like, why would you try to fix yourself with a broken brain? Because your best thinking got you here. So maybe you should take a little bit of suggestion. And that was it. So that's what I would say. For me, it always came in the form of suggestion. I would try it. If my life got better, I'd stay at it. If it didn't get better, I'd try something else.
Yeah. And it really did significantly change your trajectory and your path. One of my favorite parts about the book is one of your heroes is Ben Kingsley.
Sir Ben Kingsley.
And you get to do this movie with him. And, you know, they always say never meet your heroes, but it seems like this was a good meeting of your hero story. And he gave you this fantastic advice to follow your apostles. And it seems like your recovery is following your apostles. You found your group of people. And so you had said it would take you years to understand this. And even as you gave that advice in the book, I thought, well, what does that really mean? How can I implement this in my own life? And can you expand on this and how taking that advice has really helped you in your life?
Sure. I know you mentioned there's some younger listeners. So if you don't know Sir Ben Kingsley, he's an Oscar award winning actor. He's in his late 60s now. So a lot of his best work was done in the 80s and 90s, but well into present day. But he really came on the scene, played Gandhi. You know, he's been in so many great movies, and he's always been one of my favorite actors, my favorite actor. So the fact that I was getting my first major part in a movie with him just made no sense. It's like getting to play your first game with Jordan. And so, you know, I asked him for, on the last day of us filming together, I asked him for advice. But what I was really asking for was like the secrets to becoming the greatest actor in history. And he had the nerve to give me like life advice. And he said, well...
How dare he?
I know. I just was like, no. I need to know. Like, I need to be on the fast track to an Academy Award stat. He was like, find your apostles, surround yourself with people who make you better. And if you find yourself in a room with people that don't, leave immediately. And it took me a really long time to understand that. But then I realized that like an apostle is someone who's willing to hurt your feelings because it's what's best for you. Even at the risk of hurting your feelings, they're willing to tell you these things because it's what's best. I always say, I know there's an apostle in my life when I have this reaction. If someone tells me something and I'm not ready to hear it, and I have these four reactions, which is screw them, I'm the worst. They're probably right, but it's too late. Fine, I'll do it. Like, And that's proven true for me. And I found like so much of my life has been addition through subtraction. I thought that I needed to make myself the most attractive or the most intelligent or add all these things to myself so that I was utterly bulletproof. But instead, what I found is I had put on so many masks, so many defense mechanisms all through my teens and growing up, that it was really about getting to the root of who I was. It was about shedding these things. So now, hopefully on a good day, and it vacillates from day to day, if I'm in that place where I'm kind of okay being me, I can hear that a little bit more. Like my gut will tell me, like, listen to them. You don't like it and it doesn't feel good, but they're right. And I find we all have that voice. It just depends on how much subterfuge we've put in the way of it, how deep we buried it, because we're like, no, but I really need this money. Or no, like, I really need this person to like me. Trust me, gut. Because I do that. I'm constantly, even now, but it's better now, but it was worse years ago, where I was like, you know, the universe or karma or God or whatever you want to call it, I'd be like, listen, I know I'm on the highway of life right now, but I really need to get off this exit and go get this money. Trust me, this is going to be great for us. I'll be right back on the highway. Instead of like just trusting the process and letting a good life be the result of good living.
Wow, what an important lesson to learn. And that changes just how you live your life from here on out. Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a minute.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
And we're back.
I was surprised at how tumultuous your relationship is with acting. I had no idea that it was such a love-hate relationship. And, you know, your experience shooting Red Dawn was fascinating to me. And for those who have not seen this movie or don't know of it, it was a huge remake of another huge film. And I remember the casting process being just kind of the cream of the crop. And so you book this huge movie. And it feels almost, you'd never said imposter syndrome, but it felt a little bit like that, maybe as you were describing how you felt shooting it. I think this is such an accurate description of what a lot of actors feel like when they book what they think will be the job that takes them to the next level. So can you share this experience with our listeners? Because we get a lot of acting questions on our podcast and people who want to be in the entertainment industry. And I think from the outside, it looks like it's all roses, but there's so much internally that happens to us actors, even when something positive comes our way. And I think that's what is really interesting about your experience with Red Dawn. So can you share with our listeners about that?
Sure. So I'm 23. I've done this movie, The Whackness, with Serban Kingsley. It's sort of it's given me a little bit of legitimacy as like a grown-up actor and not just like the kid star. I'm not the funny fat guy anymore. I'm not the kid star. I'm like, the thing I always wanted to be, which was just an actor amongst actors. And I get offered this role to play Chris Hemsworth's brother in this movie, Red Dawn, which makes no sense. Like, God bless the casting director, but I think she might want to have her eyes checked. And it just did not
stop.
No, let's be real. I mean, even if I'm nice looking, we certainly don't look like brothers. Like, Miles Teller, I'd get it. They were like, you're going to play Miles Teller's brother. I'd be like, yeah. I said, Timothy Chalamet. I'd be like, yeah. Chris Hemsworth, maybe not as much. So we're doing this movie, and I think I mentioned imposter syndrome in the book, saying like, I was so overcome by imposter syndrome that I actually let it turn me into a fraud. Because imposter syndrome is a naturally occurring thing of highly ambitious people. It's not like, it's like, imposter syndrome is like getting upset that you're sore after a really hard workout. Like, yes, this is unavoidable for most of us. And if you were walking around popping buttons, thinking you were like the shit nonstop, like, then you're probably a sociopath. Like, it's natural to feel like, wow, can I rise to the occasion? What you do with that feeling and hopefully being unreactive to it, or allowing it to be an asset and driving you to be more prepared and to be a better listener to the people who are walking the path before you, then it can be great. But for me, it crippled me. And I was playing this action star, which I always dreamt of playing when I was 16 and 300 pounds, like busy alphabetizing my DVDs. Like, now I was given this opportunity and I just felt like I was the wrong guy and that I had to do an impression of Chris Hemsworth, who to me was like a man's man. So short of actually doing an Australian accent, I was like doing this awful impression of him. I abandoned everything that had ever worked for me, my comedy, my humility, vulnerability. And I just put on this like fake projection of what I thought a real man was, assuming that that's what the producers wanted, totally discarding the idea that they had eyes and knew who they were casting. And maybe they cast me for all those reasons of that I was vulnerable and comedic, but I like let go of all of that. And what proceeded was 4 months of hell of being so insecure, giving such a poor performance. And then the best part was we finished the movie. And I say in the book, it was like, it wasn't like, because people would tell me, because I would vent, I vented a lot. And people would say, you're crazy. You know, every actor's so hard on themselves. Like, the editing does magic. And I was like, no. I was like, this isn't a question of whether I got like an A or a B. This is like, I didn't finish the test in time. Like, I failed. Like, I only answered 8 out of the 50 questions. I'm screwed. There's no way this is going to be good. And then the studio, MGM, who made the movie, went bankrupt. And so now there's a movie waiting to come out, but instead of it coming out a year from when we finished, like normal movies, it's 3 years. And I'm just like, oh my God.
What torture. That's such torture.
It's such torture. I'm like, oh my God. Like, but it's already circulated in the business. Like, oh, Peck totally nosedived this one. So it's like, it's already hurting me. It's hurting me professionally, but now I'm like, it's 3 years of like, when the public sees this, I'll die. Like, I'm going to expire. Like, it's going to come out on a Friday and Saturday morning, I won't wake up. Like, I know it. Like, my ego can't handle it. And I learned a lot. I survived, but barely.
You survived. It came out and it wasn't, you know, was it what you wanted it to be? No. But did you die? No. So it's one of those things where you move on and it is okay. And now.
And not to mention, weirdly, people like will tell me, like, especially people in the service will be like, I love that movie. You shouldn't talk such shit about it. And I'm like, I'm not talking shit about the movie. I'm talking shit about me. They're like, even you weren't that bad. And I'm like, thanks.
I'll take it. But see, yeah. Now talk about moving on. I mean, you're working with Christopher Nolan now, which is probably the utmost or one of the top directors in Oppenheimer. And what's that experience like? Because the truth is, the world does continue spinning. You book another job. Everything is fantastic. And not only did you book another huge film, but this is one of the huge movies that will come out next year or the year after that we'll all see you in. So no pressure, Josh.
Thanks. No pressure. Guys, I'm going to say it here now. I have a very small part. I'm an extremely small part of a very impressive movie and cast. But, you know, to your point, right, like I end the book talking about how it basically, from when I did Red Dawn at 23 to then being like 33, 10 years later, it took me, you know, getting married, having a kid, growing up emotionally, discarding a lot of these painful things throughout my life, really facing the inside stuff. And then also recommitting to acting class and like deciding that if I'm really going to go for this thing, I have to be willing to really bare my soul and say like, am I good enough? And let go of a lot of bad habits that I had accrued over the years. And so that was like a 10-year process. And I end the book after 3 years of really not working much as an actor, getting this huge job that was really, it wasn't about the job. It was this culmination of all this inner work that I had done that it seemed to have set me up to really get this great thing, which was the show Turner and Hooch that I did on Disney Plus last year. And I was, you know, playing TV's Low Rent Tom Hanks. It was great, you know? And
to be anything Tom Hanks is great.
I'll take it. I've met him once and he's incredibly lovely. It's not fair. I'm like, you can't be this talented and this nice. But Hemsworth is the same way. So I don't know. It's weird. They must hang out in the same circles. But then, you know, when I started, but that show got canceled. And like, and I say it in the book. I was like, by the time this book comes out, this show might be the biggest thing or canceled or just somewhere in the middle. But it doesn't matter. And people would bring it up to me in podcasts. They'd be like, well, it got canceled. So what do you think about the ending of your book? And I'm like, it wasn't about the job. It was the culmination of all this work. And like, and to your point, like, or I could end it on Oppenheimer, right? Like, but then I booked Oppenheimer, you know, like, but that this is life, right? And I'm sure there's more canceled stuff in my future and maybe more wins. It's life.
Well, and that's the point of the book, too, is that you realized for the first time that it really isn't about what you're working on. It isn't about, you know, whether the show's canceled or the biggest success, that you figured out the key to life and finding your happiness and loving yourself and knowing who you are. I mean, you share a lot about how long it took to love little Josh, you know, little. And even in one of your social media posts, you post a photo of yourself and then a photo of you back when you were in your overweight phase of life. And you said, this guy wrote a book about this guy and how much it took to love him. And so how do you now view yourself? And what would you say to little Josh if you could say one thing to him, knowing where you are in life and how, not just career-wise, but how you found success within and happiness, which really, it sounds so cheesy, but it is true. Like once you find what makes you happy and what makes your world spin, you can just kind of revolve around that. And then no matter what happens work-wise, you know who you are.
It's a great question. I talk about in the book how for such a long time, I wanted to erase my origin story. And I talk about me as a kid in the third person, which is odd, except it just seemed, for my life had become so disciplined and was sort of like the picture of, you know, recovery in some respects and like working hard and keeping the weight off and recommitting myself to acting or whatever it was. And it was like, I had manifested this life that I had dreamt of. And I would look at that kid and go like, well, that's a picture of lack of willpower and lack of self-control. And he solidified himself in, I also felt like, oh, like I'm constantly at this uphill battle even still because I solidified myself in that way. So most people view me as that. And what it took was me realizing like that kid had to be so much stronger than I have to be today. And he wasn't equipped, you know, like he didn't have the tools that I have today. Never mind, he just, you know, at 13, who has the brain to be able to sort of navigate those things? Like we're all in a bit of fight or flight, like, you know, just sort of self-preservation mode at that age, doing the very best that we can. And so like it allowed me to really like love, I was able to love this kid because I love my life today. I think that's the big part of it. And so if you're having, you know, issues or, you know, reconciling sort of your past, and I'm not commenting on other people's experience or trauma because everyone's experience is different than mine. But I would say, you know, loving yourself today is very indicative of being able to love your past self. And I just knew, and it sounds trite and corny, but it's like, I couldn't be here today without that kid. Like, and if I had, you know, been able to teleport and at 15 and said, you know, to my 15-year-old self and said, dude, one day we're going to play John Stamos's son in a TV show. Like, it's going to work out. Like, A, it would have either changed some course of my life, but also I don't think I would have been capable of hearing that at 15. You know, like, so I always want to, like, give people, or I don't want to say I always want to give, but if anyone's ever, especially with the weight stuff, people would be like, do you have any advice? Because I know everyone wants a hack, like, because I wanted a hack, you know, I didn't want to just hear like, I eat a little less and work out a little bit more. Like, I was like, no, you don't understand. But what I always say is that, like, if you're in a place where you're just feeling utterly over it, and you're sick and tired of being sick and tired, and your way has gotten you to a place where you just feel hopeless, then I would say, I'm sorry you're going through that, but it's a great place to start. Because I never learned anything on a good day, and pain has been a great motivator in my life. So if you're in that place, I'd say you are perfectly poised to take a step out of that and to try something new.
Josh, thank you for not only writing this awesome memoir that's truly entertaining, Happy People Are Annoying, is available anywhere you can get books. It's also available on Audible. I highly recommend hearing Josh with his S's go through this lovely life story. And you just are full of, you know what? It sounds cheesy. I was going to say the word inspiration, but it's true. You are. You really are inspiring and so lovely. Thank you for joining us today and taking us through your wonderful life story. And I really wish you the best. And I know we are not only going to see you in lovely movies, but we are going to see you everywhere on social media, everything. And we can't wait for what's next.
Oh, I so appreciate you having me. You're awesome at this. And I love chatting with you. Thank you.
You know, I relate to Josh Peck in so many ways because some of my life has been in the spotlight for a really long time. And I really respect him and him being able to open up about what it's really like. And his recovery story alone is truly compelling. I know we asked a few questions and he went in to detail with us, but if you have a chance to pick up the book, the amount of detail he goes into, and he is so raw and honest and real, specifically in this part of the book, I really commend him. And I was a fan before this interview, and now I'm a huge fan. So Josh, thank you so much for joining us. I really hope you guys have learned so much from his story. And I hope he comes out with another book in maybe 10 to 20 years, because he's really good at this. And once again, I highly recommend Audible because Josh is an entertainer and he tells the jokes really well. And it's a really wonderful immersive experience. Make sure you check out his book, Happy People Are Annoying, available wherever books are sold. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Directionally Challenged as much as I did. We have another great one coming for you next week. And until then, take care. We'll see you then.
Directionally Challenged is a production of Pineapple Productions.
Produced by Melissa D. Montz.
Edited by Diane King.
Post-production sound by Chris Henry.
Music by Joe King.
And advertising partnership with Acast.